The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me on the podcast right now, and of course you can catch this on video, and you see Paul in his smart tie there, hair done. You always look smart, Paul. That's the thing. You're a smart investor, full-time investor, equity analyst. And
you're very polite there, Justin. You didn't want my wife and my kids say. They're so a scruffy little devil. So,
To be fair, I've only seen you from the waist up. I have no idea what's going on downstairs.
You don't want to know.
No, I know.
It's a bit like the market. In fact, that's a bit like the market. It's kind of a game in two halves as much as anything, because I have sort of like, you know, you have a look at what's happening at the sort of top level. And obviously, you know, the VIX is now below sort of 17, which is suggesting actually, you know, a bit of complacency there. And it's sort of like, is it the calm before the storm? Because that has been a really quite a good, strong contrarian bet. When the VIX gets the volatility, the index gets above sort of 30, it's a time to buy. And when it gets below 20 and it's currently 17, it's a time to sell. So I do wonder, but I would say sort of broad picture, I'd use an analogy that the sort of like the markets are playing a game of chess at the moment. You've got sort of like the bulls on one side playing white, who are winning, and you know, it's been sort of like the market's been sort of held up by continued consumer strength, and the bond yield curve sort of like in the treasury is coming down, inflation expectations in the States, not the UK, coming down, and that optimistic scenario that 2024 is going to be a bit of a rebound and we're going to get a Ukraine ceasefire, which is, so the white sort of winning, but black has now on the bears, which is I'm sort of, you know, as I've been sort of cautiously or reluctant bear for some time, the sort of the black pieces have got some pretty big sort of moves ahead of them. And you've got sort of like M2 money supplies. We talked about, you know, decreasing, in fact, declining substantially. You've got that banking crisis, and you can see that through the senior loan officers' reports that you've got credit contraction. And you're actually starting to see sort of like, you know, inflation expectations now ticking up for the back of the year in sort of like the Michigan survey, which was from last week. So there's some pretty big forces. And my view is that this game is, the game of chess is going to go on for about 3 years. And black is going to lose, white's going to win, but in 2025. And I can actually see, and I did a sort of like a quick sort of like valuation of what I think the S&P will hit out at. And I think they'll do $220 per share in 2024. Stick a 16 multiple on it, and you get roughly around about sort of 3,500. And it's currently 4,200. So I think there's going to be really a bit of pain. And I would say you could find, and I know it's just still psychological, but with the VIX at 17, that smacks to me is that actually we could see a turning point quite quickly, albeit the Q1, you know, if you look at the US earnings season, the corporate earnings, it's been really strong. I mean, I don't know what you've made of it so far.
Yeah, but do you know what? It's odd. I mean, part of me thinks, put it this way, that I started investing a bit more. On, I think I was almost 40, 50% in cash at one point. But now I went to the point where I was almost 60 or 70% invested, and I started pulling back, and I thought, I'm not convinced. Part of me has an underlying bearishness to it, and I think, I don't think it's as simple as that. The market's just, you know, like I said, our inflation, that's annoying me. The UK inflation is in
only
double
10%.
Yeah, well, twice now the experts have, you know, misforecast this. And even the Bank of England was saying it should be 9.2% by now, and it's still 10.1%. And we're the only, I think, European country in double digits still. What is going on? And I said, you know, going back to the financial crash, you said that central banks could pretty much solve that overnight by, you know, reassuring people, saying we're backing up the banks, we're doing this. With inflation, they can't do that. It's not an on-off switch. They can deal with it. It can last for ages. And so that's why, you know, it will have an eroding effect, to like, especially with interest rates higher, over a longer term, I think. And so it will be volatile for a long time. Certain companies will do okay. This week, my perception, even last week, was very bearish. I don't know why. I don't know if just sometimes you can be bearish and it's completely misplaced. And other times I'm thinking, okay, let's not actually go fully invested. Let's hold back a bit with some cash here, because there could be a bumpy road ahead. So I think there will be.
What do you think is going to happen? What do you think is the Fed going to push interest rates up by a quarter point, and the Bank of England likewise, given the hotter than anticipated inflation read? Because you have core inflation in the UK, you know, at over 6%. You've got wages at 6.5%, and that is sticky. That's stripping out energy and food, you know, that volatility. So that really is. And you're not, it isn't that much better actually in the States. I mean, you still got core, I think, of around about 4.5-5% as well. So what's your view on interest rates?
Yeah, well, it's odd. I mean, I think they'll go with, you know, it's almost like they don't want to scare the markets as well, but they've got to do something. They've got to stick to their path. I mean, what's the least unexpected outcome? If they said, we're stopping right here, would that scare the markets or scare people or whatever? Or think, do they know something, you know, there's going to be more economic downturn happening than that we know about? So I think, if anything, they're going to stick with the plan of, you know, of what's predicted, what's forecast. But like I said, the Bank of England have no excuse to sort of stop right now if that's the way they're going to deal with inflation, is raising interest rates, because it's not working at the moment. Mm. And with the lag effect, the fact of maybe long, but they've got to sort of stick with the plan if that's the plan
When you say you stick with the forecast, what forecast do you mean? Do you mean their forecast or the market's forecast? Because that's a big difference.
Yeah. So what's is it sort of consensus?
The yield curve. The yield curve in the States is saying we're going to get interest rate cuts of roughly around about 75 basis points by the end of the year, which is frankly nuts in my view, but
that says then the reason why that would happen, isn't it, is because of, you know, bad economics, you know, job numbers going down, growth going down. And what's worrying is this is worrying. If inflation is still high and you've got rising unemployment and growth going down, that's stagflation, and that is not good. That's the last time that happened. So there is that worry. It's hard to say, is that going to happen? Is that going to play out? Is that what we're worried about? Is it likely to play out? I don't know. It's just all this worries about, isn't it? So that's
I think last week we got a really important data point, which was solidified again, you know, earlier this week, because in the US we've had the banking, you know, the results, and we've had the major banks and some of the small regionals all reporting. And what's actually been is a really much better than feared expectation, because deposits have stabilized, i.e. after the Silicon Valley Bank. You've had your big money center banks really knocking the ball out of the park on net interest margin. So what that means, if you're a central banker, is that actually the coast is clear in terms of financial stability. And you're seeing sticky inflation, in fact, worse than you anticipated inflation. I just cannot see, if you're a central banker, that you're going to basically cut interest rates unless, as you rightly say, there's another big sort of black swan which happens that creates financial stability. So I actually think it's locked. Unless we see a major problem, which could well happen, because we have been pushing up, I just can't see the central bankers coming off their plan of keeping interest rates at roughly around about 5, well, in the US, 5.5%, and in the UK, they're going to push it up as well, because the coast is clear now on the banks. It doesn't mean there won't be another problem like, you know, commercial real estate or auto loans, you know, the cars rolling over or whatever it is, or the housing market crashing. It's unlikely, but, you know, those kind of things happening and causing problems. But given financial stability is now back, you know, sort of okay, and we've given it the all clear for the time being, that is, it's going to be higher for longer. I just can't see any other alternative.
No, exactly. And I suppose, what's the next stress point? You know, like, so we've had the banks, you know, feeling the stress. If that's largely behind us, like you say there's other areas of the economy that could feel it really, you know, harshly. And could it take the... You know,
well, I'll tell you one, which is going to be, okay... Yeah. Is if you own large cap tech stocks that have rocketed this year, because if we're right, okay, and let's just park this massive, great, you know, potential black swan that we're going to get another financial instability, which there is, I do think there's more than a tail risk probability that could happen, that we're going to break something else, yeah? But let's just assume it doesn't and the coast is all clear and interest rates stay higher. Well, what's going to happen? Yeah, the yield curve is going to increase. It's going to all elevate up, and we're going to get 5.5% or there and thereabouts on sort of the 2-year. And the 10-year is going to go up from what, 3.6% up to around 4-5%, whatever it is, or 4.2 or something. And the big tech stocks are going to roll over because they're on an average PE of over 25. So where is the next shoe to drop? Well, if you're in the large cap Microsoft's, Apple, just on valuation grounds, it's totally unsustainable.
Yeah. No, do you know what? That's very important. Everything sort of comes back to value, doesn't it, at the end of the day? And you can get away with it for a while, a rally into higher levels of valuation. But that's at the moment what I'm looking at. I'm paying attention a little bit to sort of more, to saying, is that cheap? So I even see stocks now, that are good growth and a PE of 20 or something. I think, yeah, it's not cheap, though, is it? And so
you're
I'm
like
a
me.
Bit cautious, I know.
Yeah, you're turning into a value investor. Fantastic.
Well, it's annoying because...
it's annoying.
There'll be other opportunities out there. It's almost that the market's changed, and you've got to say, you've got to see that. I'm looking at companies that I think that's cheap. I think that's undervalued, or it can't get a lot cheaper based on, it's close to what asset values, an asset value or something, whatever. But I mean, I'm looking at that now, thinking this is silly cheap. There are some opportunities out there, but there's also some companies out there thinking, that's still not cheap, considering,
Yeah, I mean, I think when one company, which is silly cheap, came out with a trading update yesterday, which is Cake Box, which is the sort of the UK's go-to provider of fresh cream cakes. And I was lucky enough to interview the new CFO, Michael Botha, and the CEO, Sukhtam Dahl, yesterday. And the big message, there's two big messages. First of all, they had a strong second half, and they've now gone back into like-for-like, shop sales growth, which is great. But the large part of that is because the consumer is now acclimatized to higher inflation rates, i.e., and you think about it, that's not actually a crazy thing to say. Simply because, I mean, look at my behavior. I mean, you had that sticker shock. That the energy went through the roof 9 months ago or 12 months ago, and everybody was turning their heating off and economizing and just feeling, crikey, we're in a really tough area. Now we've gone through 6 to 9 months of that. We've had enough of sort of like, running our budgets on a shoestring, et cetera. And we're going out and effectively, Sue, what he basically said was that, he's seeing more traffic in his shops and through his online stores, that and people are spending more on cakes, even though they haven't actually pushed the prices up much at all compared to normal sort of food inflation. So that says to me is the consumer is now normalized, has become accustomed to this higher inflation, is going back to, to normal behavior. And you can see that on the experiences because, the flights and the travel is really strong. You had some of the airlines already saying that they've got record bookings for the summer. And you've also seen, your restaurants and your pubs very busy. They even are around here, even on a Monday and a Tuesday night. And he's seeing the same thing, in his shops and he's online. And the beauty about, Cake Box is it's a franchise model. It's cash flow positive, strongly cash flow positive. It's capital light because the franchisees pay for the actual shop and the upkeep of the fixtures and fittings and stuff like that. And, they're trading and they've got a strong balance sheet. They've got about 6.3 million pounds of net cash, which I think equates to around about 15p per share. You strip that out into the share price, even though the shares have gone up to about 130, it's gone up about near 5-10% since yesterday. But you strip that 15p out and it's trading on around about sort of 10-10.5 times PE for a growth business, which is a franchise model, and it's got lots of opportunities. So when it comes to sort of value, I mean, that's, put it this way, if I had the choice of paying 25 times for Apple or paying 10.5 times for Cake Box, I know which one I would eat all day long.
Cake over Apple. Yeah.
Exactly.
But did you know what? It's funny you say that. We do have this, when we have these initial shock, you get the mass media reporting on something and then we all have shock and we pull our belts in. Mm. But after a while, even with, like the war in Ukraine, you see some still horrific things happening there. But after a while, it becomes blasé to you. It's nothing new. So you adjust to it. And that happens with us as a cost of living. You realise things have have gone up. And so you, you know, rein everything in. And you realise, in fact, they have gone up, but I can still afford them. And what's the point, you know, not living life?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And and also, you know, you look at the strikes and stuff like that, you know, the rail strikes. Well, it just becomes wallpaper now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You don't travel on the days of the strike, simple as that. And it just loses its effect, certainly on the sort of big shout in the news, etc. And it's not covered. In fact, we had the same thing with the pandemic, didn't we, in terms of once we'd actually got the vaccine, they started taking off all the stats and it just became noise, as in, like, you know, people were less concerned about it. I mean, it was obviously, you know, it's a background, but as you say, you just become accustomed to it. So I think that's the sort of key takeaway, you know, for investors, is if you're in an area such that is sort of like, you know, affordable treat for people, and they want to go out and do it, and it's a value service, then they're going to continue, whether that's restaurants, whether it's travel for the holiday, whether it's, you know, sort of like it, going into, you know, sort of cake boxes, shops and buying and spending a bit of money on a, you know, birthday cake or a celebration cake that they're doing. And so that's one thing which is important for investors, that they get that acclimatization. But the other thing is you're also seeing quite a, you know, a differentiation, you know, a polarization between the stocks that are doing well, which do have these brands and do have the service, the quality stocks, and actually companies which are performing poorly, because you see a lot of the, you know, the pure online boys who are listed, you know, in 2020 and 2021, they're still struggling like anything. I mean, that, you know, if you actually look at some of their models, they're still seeing quite big decreases. So you are getting a lot of polarization. But if you're a stock picker, that's pretty good, because what it means is this, that you've got this overlay of good valuation, strong balance sheet, secular growth, and you're getting it at a rock bottom prices. So there is a nice bit of sort of like upside there if you're looking at, you know, past sort of the next 3 to 6 months.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? Talking about, you know, experience, that's why I still hold sort of XP Factory. I mean, I've seen that, you know,
yes,
it's always been full. I did a friend of mine actually trying to, where did they, went into town trying to get in there. Someone just went into town just trying to get on the off chance and getting, you know, into Boom Battle Bar. Couldn't do it, fully booked out. And I think
that's great.
You know, there's a certain level of, and they are targeting that area, the young people sort of, you know, don't really
experience, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't have, you know, mortgage payments and all this stuff. They don't have all that. They don't pay the, you know, utility bills. And I mean, they are like 30 million market cap. They're expected to do about 40 million in revenue this year and about 6 million EBITDA, you know, adjusted pre-tax profit of 2.3, I think. And the growth is going to continue. But yet, because the sentiment, everyone's worried about the cost of living, just go along to one of their bars and see how busy they are. You realise there's no cost of living worry there at all. So, you know, yeah, it sometimes, you know, there's opportunities just because the sentiment have knocked these things down. And
I think it's a best in class operator with something that consumers want and go out and enjoy. And they're doing it. And as you say, it's difficult to get in.
Yeah,
I mean, another one in that consumer space was basically, they came out with a trading update year end, was Supreme. And I talked about this last time, which is basically about 50% of the business, or in sales terms, is vaping, which is their 8-8 vape ban. But it actually generates about 2/3 of its gross profit. And then the other divisions are batteries, lighting, sports nutrition, and a bit of some other FMCG brands, etc. But their vaping brand from the trading update is absolutely flying. I mean, it went up like 75% year on year last year, driven by sort of a bit of M&A but a lot of organic growth. And as I say, this is the highest gross margin part of their business. And they just like had a really strong standout second half, generating a huge amount of cash. And they're only slightly sort of like, you know, net debt. So I think their net debt's about 0.3 of EBITDA, et cetera. But given, I mean, the shares have gone up about 10% since the trading update. In fact, they're up about 20% since I talked about them to you only 2 weeks ago. So, you know, they've done pretty well. But even at current levels, they're still trading at 10.5 times. You know, sort of like, you know, price earnings ratio, and, you know, generating a lot of cash. So, you know, you just can't escape that. And the thing that people miss in terms of, you know, sort of vaping, etc., they sort of get hung up in terms of, oh, is this healthy and all this sort of stuff. Well, actually, let's just look at the facts. Yeah, the NHS I think about 7 days ago, announced that it was giving out 1 million vaping starter kits to, you know, smokers to get them off, because it's the most effective way to get smokers to quit. In fact, it's twice as effective as using sort of like, you know, tobacco, you know, sort of like nicotine patches and gums and stuff like that than anything else. And so, you know, when it comes down to when the rubber hits the road, is this something that is helping, you know, reduce the number of lung cancer patients? The answer to that is yes. Is it reducing the cost to the NHS? Yes, massively. And that's why they're giving out a million of these free starter kits, because it's proved to be effective to get a, to get people out. So, and I actually think vaping is actually less. You know, okay. I mean, you don't have any, cancerous tobacco or anything like that. That's absolutely, you know, convinced of that. That's medically proven. But when it comes to sort of, you know, I think it's more healthy than alcohol. You know, if you've got somebody who's all over it, if you're a person who's overeating or drinking too much, you're going to cause yourself a shed load more problems than you are if you do a bit of vaping. You know, and you don't get any benefits for overeating or drinking, but you do get benefits for smoke from vaping if you're a smoker. And not, you know, 95%, in fact almost 100% in lots of cases, of people who vape are smokers, because there aren't that many people who just vape who've never smoked. Most of them are smokers. I mean, I don't vape because, you know, basically I don't need to.
Yeah, there's two sides to it, isn't there, the controversy? First of all, they said, without doubt, it's better alternative than smoking cigarettes, because you've got the tar and, of course, the carcinogens. And yes, people should be pushed onto that, definitely, because, you know, that's a tar damaging your lungs. But there's the worry about, I suppose, kids as a fad taking it up as a hobby.
Yes.
Never previously. So that side should be discouraged. If you've never smoked before, you shouldn't have taken it up as a fad or a hobby.
That's very small.
Nicotine. Yeah. Yeah.
That's
nicotine.
Very small. The government ran a big survey. I mean, a massive, you know, sort of nationwide survey in 2021. So only 2 years ago, looking at, you know, who actually vaped. Yeah. And what it said for adults, i.e. people over 16 and above, over 99% were previous smokers who vaped, okay? So there was only 1% who had not smoked before. And when they looked at 11 to 15-year-old, 98% of 15 to 11-year-olds who vaped were previous smokers. So, yes, I mean, you could say, OK, it's increased marginally since then because the vaping market has increased. But actually, we're still talking, you know, undoubtedly, just from the stats, the hard numbers that the government has produced, undoubtedly, the vast, vast majority of people who vape have or would have smoked, you know, because we were kids and stuff. I mean, crikey. I mean, I luckily avoided smoking.
Like Alka-Pops. The trouble is with vapes, they're all very bright and they're all very attractive. It's like Alka-Pops back in the day, wasn't it? You're trying to attract, you know, younger people.
Yeah.
So maybe you should just change that in some ways and not make it
But just push yourself when you were a kid, when you were growing up. And stuff. How many of your mates and girlfriends and stuff like that smoked? There was masses. And the reason is because it's basically trendy, you know. And so consequently, the people, you know, people who have vaped generally are almost certainly were or have or, you know, are smokers. And it is like, because it's they're going to do it. And if you give them an alternative, which is not killing them or killing other people in passive smoking, it's got to be a benefit. And that's what the NHS and the government have said, you know, last week. I mean, it's...
Do you know what? I caught my son with he's 13 with a vape, right? I said, first of all, it's illegal. You're not allowed to do it. And I thought back, I gave him a real big row on it, saying nicotine is highly addictive. You don't want to get involved with that. And I realised, back in the day, I was actually doing that with cigarettes, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Worse, you know,
exactly.
So, it's a thing you go through, but I did say, you know, they can be addictive. Don't start it. And, you know, it's very good for ex-smokers who are trying to come off. But it's not much starting. So as a hobby, Fred, I suggest basketball or something else, you know. Anyway.
And then you look at, you just look at it, say, top picture. They're both, you know, Cake Box and, you know, Supreme consumer brands growing well, you know, strong, good, decent pricing power of their own brands. And, you know, they're basically trading at 10 to 10.5p, you know, PE when you strip out the cash. I mean, and they're generating lots of money. So, you know, it seems for me, those kind of things are no-brainers if you compare it to sort of big cap tech or anything. Those are safe areas that, you know, if we go through a hard recession, because they're affordable treats or value-conscious brands in the case of Supreme, that in a downturn, they're actually going to do pretty well.
Yeah. It's one of my bigger caps, because doing well. It's struggling to break above a certain level on the chart, Money Supermarket. But they had a good update. I mean, even looking at, I'm just let me get it up here. But even
My dad loves it. He's chatting to me every week about Money Supermarket. He's made some good money on it already.
Yeah, exactly. Look at this. This is Q1. This is versus last year's Q1. Insurance up like 23%. Money up 9%. Home services, which are energy, which of course is largely flat, but it's up 5%. Travel up 63%. Overall, up 15% on last year. So it's decent. They say, you know, once energy kicks back in, that's really going to stoke it up. But they're very confident of hitting their figures, which is, they say, EBITDA region of around about 124 million. Mm-hmm. Which would put them in, 10 times EBITDA, pretty much. So, and decent dividend, you know? So I think that once that energy market kicks in, it's going to give it, like the second boosters kind of thing.
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah. I'm sort of like, and the reason why I sold it was as much as, because I was worried at the time that the energy was going away and wouldn't be, because it was Liz Truss who was going to be keeping it, the prices sort of nailed down for like 3 years. And obviously you had that Amazon saying that they were going to launch a price comparison site, and that's come to nothing, you know, so because they've got bigger problems, Amazon. They're reducing costs. They don't want to start something else and have another big sort of like, you know, investment they're going to have to make in a price comparison site. So, yeah, yeah. I think I made a bum call on that one, perfectly honest. But, hey, you know, it's one of those at least it was a bum call and I made some money. So that was
exactly, a bum call and losing lots of money. Money is a different thing. I know, it's fine. I know, it's a different kind of missing out. I know, but there we are.
And another one which has got rocket boosters in it is Argentex. Mm. And I own the shares, and I almost bought some more actually this week, because they crazily went down after the trading update, etc. And it was a full year results, but they gave us a trading update for Q1, and the sales there were up 34% like for like. Absolutely storming. And again, they've got a shed load of cash, sort of 22p per share, currently trading at roughly around about 115. You strip out the cash, and I think the PE comes down. You say it's about 10.3 when I calculated it last. I mean, it's just a ridiculously value, you know, good value, generating about 11, 12%, you know, free cash flow yield. And so this is absolutely minting money. Got lots of growth opportunities in terms of, you know, overseas with Holland. And I interviewed the guys there and the CEO, Harry Adams. I mean, he was really excited about, the opportunity in Europe, because it's enormous given their bench strength they have, you know, in the UK, and they're growing it in, you know, over in Europe. And there was also, which was really interesting, great bit of insight. And I suggest people have a look at it if they haven't done. They had the CTO on there, the technology guy, and he was really talking up, you know, the talking about how they're going to, you know, improve and release additional versions of their software, their technology, to give sort of like multi-currency IBAN accounts and all this sort of stuff across the world. So again, that's just dropped through to the bottom line. So yeah, I know the shares, it's just bizarre. The shares went down on the news. Why? I really don't know. I think it's just some people wanting to exit, tidy up their position, or selling into high liquidity. I'm not sure. But I mean, I was very close to buying some more shares, because I mean, with a 12% or 11-12% cash flow yield, 10 times or 10 and a half times PE multiple, plus this is on relatively depressed earnings, because 2023 is still the investment phase, but 2024, 2025 is going to see a major uplift. And I wouldn't be surprised if somebody bought these out as well, because, you know, they really are, you know, demonstrating strong momentum in the business. I mean, 34% top line growth. I mean, how can anybody complain about that?
Yeah, the margins are very good. I mean, the concern, profit went down a bit, but the chart is odd, and it's hit some resistance there. And so it's looking like it may need to go, because it's risen. Let's be honest, the performance has been done very well. It's been, back in July, for example, last year, it was like 72 pence, and it doubled to 140. And so you may see that profit taken, and you may just have to go sideways for a while. But in that time, of course, the business can improve. Like you say, they've spent a bit more investing.
Yeah,
and all that stuff.
I mean, you raise a very good point. This is something that investors should take away as a principle elsewhere. Yeah, you can have instances where the share price goes down but the intrinsic value of the business goes up. And that's what happened because, you know, you look at the, they're knocking the ball out of the park. My valuation has gone up, and Singer's ticked up from about 180 to now they're at £2 per share. And I can absolutely understand that because, you know, the business is such an, is a, I mean, it's got a rock solid balance sheet, you know, 22 pence per share, you know, of just net cash on the business. And it's generating a shed load of cash and investing for growth. And we know that whole sector's doing well because you just look at Equals and that's doing similarly. I mean, it had a fantastic first, similar sort of growth, I think, in the in Q1. So it isn't as though it's a one-off outlier. I mean, this whole sector is absolutely flying. They are winning, you know, hand over fist market share from the traditional banks. And you can understand why, because the banks have just had a bit of a shock. They're probably pulling back some of their technology investment in terms of what they're going to put into, you know, their Forex trading platforms, etc. They're going to really struggle to keep up with these guys. And as I say, I just, and the smaller sort of operators, because the bar in terms of compliance has gone up, then you know, the competition is going to be decreasing at that area. So I actually think that, you know, there's going to be a fewer number of quality survivors, and Argentex is going to be right up there. And Equals, and as I say, if the shares carry on going down, I'm going to be mopping up. I tell you, putting some of my cash. How much cash have you got now? Then, you know, in your portfolio, because I think you had about 40-45% last time.
No, it's come. It went down to about 30%. It's gone back up to 38. It's around about so it's close to 40%. Yeah.
Okay, we're about the same then.
I've invested a little bit, a tiny little bit. I mean, I don't know if you saw the results last week from Good Energy. Now I've been watching them for a while. But they've changed the business model. The founder and CEO is now gone. There's a new CEO in there, and they're aiming towards a more high margin sort of energy business. And they've got
what's the principle of Good Energy? What's their USP?
They've got about 277,000 customers.
Which type? Consumer business?
Yeah, but both. They've got 1,700 independent suppliers of energy to them. They sell it back into the grid and all that stuff. And they're now going into heat pumps and all this stuff. But they did own sort of wind farms. They sold that. It was a lot of debt with that. They cleared off the debt.
Is the idea of Good Energy to be zero carbon electricity?
Yeah, pretty much.
Is it?
Oh, no, the community completely believe in that. Like, so they've got one of the lowest cost, you know, acquisition customers around because they're really bought into this model of, you know, 100% renewable energy, and they can sort of, you know, fix up solar panels and all the heat pumps to these customers at very low acquisition. Like, so they've got 277,000 customers. They are the second, I think, although the first biggest, what is it? The biggest lead independent in feed, I'll go here. They are the second, largest feed-in tariff operator in the UK, highest profitability customer in the industry. Now, they sold this, like I said, wind farm business. So they've got 24 million quid in cash. I think about 4 million is restricted. They've also owned 49% of Zapmap, which is the largest EV charging map in the UK, which you can set up with subscriptions. You can pay through that. That's and together, those are way above their market cap. Their market cap is like 35 million, and they're profitable last year. So I just think at the moment, they've got like, 19 million in cash, and they're looking towards higher margin businesses, and they are profitable. I think the profit before tax in the period was about 3.1. In fact, it was a lot more than that with the profit with the Zapmap realized value. But so 3.1 with EBITDA 4.4. And yet, like I said, they are, you know, the turnover was, I mean, due to wholesale prices, it was 248 million last year. But what I quite like is that they are growing their margins. All they need to do is improve those margins, and they are heading towards that. Like I said, they had a lot of debt, got rid of the debt, they got lots of cash, lots of time, and the valuation is just, you know, based on cash and Zapmap, basically. It's nothing else.
Have you spoken to the company yet?
Yeah, I'm hoping to, yes, speak to the CEO very soon. And
Right, good, okay. Well, you have to report back here. How you go? Because I'd be interested in that. Sounds like a pretty interesting sort of USP differentiating model there.
Yeah, and if you look at the whole ethos, they're very into that. And in fact, the founder, I think it was Julian, I think it was, but set it up with years ago. She's way ahead of a term, but by saying it, renewable energy, a community of people. And like I said, they're into this about, you know, the 1,700 independent suppliers, all that stuff. And they are into this a lot. But now they've just, you know, changed the business model a little bit to be more profitable, higher margins, and less debt, which I quite like. I always liked them before, but I mean, I thought they had a bit of debt. Now that debt's largely cleared off, pretty much, and they've got a tump load of cash, profitable. And like I said, where are they? 35 million market cap, something ridiculous. So, 37.
Like, I mean, there's lots of, you know, small. I mean, I think that, again, that's another sort of like, you know, important takeaway. And we've had plenty of them today. But, you know, you go at the top end, the really mega cap, and it's expensive. But actually, I was looking at the sort of like, you know, the indices, and we've had overall equities, you know, got the S&P 500 up sort of 8%. You've had NASDAQ up 17% this year. But actually, when you look at AIM small, you know, just the AIM index, it's flat to negative actually this year so far. And so what that says to me is that we entered the year with real bargain territories, and actually we're still at bargain territories. And you can see that just through the numbers. What you've just talked about through from, you know, good energy looks to be cheap for a growing stock. And the same thing with, you know, sort of like Supreme, Argentex, and Capox. So it comes down to how it comes down to that game of chess as I'm talking about. Yeah, who's going to win it? White is going to win it. The bulls are going to win eventually. It all depends on how strong counter moves the bears with the black are going to put with this, you know, contraction and corporate, and what your time horizons are. Because if you're short term sensitive in terms of your portfolio, then you probably want to stay cautious and have a lot of cash. But actually, if you're prepared to take a longer term view and sort of like trade through the volatility, by 2025, 2026, we should see a really good sort of like, you know, outcome for a lot of these stocks that are best in class and trading at retractive valuations.
Yeah, isn't it? So I mean, I'm just looking at the broker forecast here, and they say Canaccord it is. And they've got on good energy, 475 pence target, and that's bidding on based on a 6.4 times EV/EBITDA for 2024 and 4.7 for 2025. So it's, you know, it's,
and what's its share price now?
It's at 222. And then
okay, so that's about what, 100% upside or something.
Yeah, yeah. And I just think it's almost like that. How low can companies go when you've got like 24 million
yes,
in cash?
You might
cut 35 million, and your investment value in Zapmap is valued again as double that. So it's just nuts. So you can't go a lot lower, I don't think. It's just, you know.
Well, hey, you know, let's be clear about it. How, that is a great question. I love that. How low can things go? And we know they can go flipping low. You just look at, you know, we've had Verici, which went down to about 6 or 5p and is now at 13, which is like in a, you know, only the last month. We've had Saeta, which went down to like mid-20s and it's currently trading at about 60p. I mean, it just shows you, in the small cap land, you do get silly valuations, don't you? I mean, you just, it isn't so much how low can it go, it's how silly that we can get it, and it can go very silly.
Yeah, and I would say as well, don't go big on anything because it can get silly. I mean, I mentioned, you know, so Destiny Farm and just before, and saying how ridiculous the, you know, three independent brokers there have an average valuation of £2.80 a share. They're now 32 pence. Now they were like 180 a year ago. This is before they had one asset back then. They didn't have a deal on it. They were going through phase two trials. Yeah. They're approaching phase two. And now they've gone through phase two trials on both assets. They've got a deal on one. They've got a deal coming up with another one. A rest of the world deal on the first asset they've done a deal with in America of. And it's like at 32 pence a share. They were like six times higher than this like 12 months back. And they weren't as advanced. So, and they got cash. So it doesn't, there's a lot of stuff out there. I mean, in fact, Saeta and all that was sold off massively. Verici, and like I said, some of those were like Verici was at cash levels, and I think.
It was absolutely nuts. Yeah. Another company that came out with a sort of like an update was again Avacta, and I think they've got their prelims next week. But they said a couple of days ago, or was it 3 days ago? I can't remember. But their second league candidate for their precision platform, their AVA 3996. It's just been presented at a really the world's biggest international cancer conference out in Florida, which says to me that they're pretty damn confident in terms of the preclinical data that they're getting. And the difference, but they've got two major sort of like, you know, drug targets in the precision at the moment in sort of either preclinical or clinical. You've got the AVA 6000, which is the pro-doxorubicin, which is currently going through at, you know, phase one. Trials to basically establish a maximum tolerated dose and then the optimum tolerated dose in other ones. So that's making really, but the data that, as I say, it all works off the same sort of like, you know, technology, which is this effectively FAP up activated chemo warhead release into hard tumors. But the pro-doxorubicin essentially freezes or cancels out and stops a tumor growing, whereas the AVA3996, this second candidate, absolutely zaps a hard tumor. It's demonstrated that the actual active chemo warhead, I mean, it's so toxic on its own that it's hardly ever used. But if it's got this this precision technology, it can be used safely, and they've seen that in preclinical trials, with animals, with mice, etc. And if that comes, then it'll zap tube. It was actually you'll be clear of tubers. You may not even need surgery either. So that's a really big, a booster, because it means that they've got, different candidates all going through using the same technology. So if one works, they should all work. And they hit the sort of like, we can stop growth and we can get rid of it if it's a real problem. So, yeah, I think it was really, very, very positive. Anyway, as I say, we've got a big news flow coming out next week in terms of their prelims. But, I think it's this, the R&D technology they have there under the bonnet in terms of their precision platform is top notch. In fact, their other side of the growth platform, the Affirma platform as well, is doing really well in terms of its third party royalties, its own sort of diagnostics. So we'll hear more next week. But I thought it was a good point worth pointing out to investors, because you don't go to the world's biggest cancer or oncology conference and, out in Florida and present something unless you're pretty confident that, you get the world's best, biggest and most known key opinion leaders, plus doctors, physicians, industry experts, who then mark the card and will be watching it, and therefore you've got to be pretty confident when you sort of like raise the awareness that this is going to work. And I think it's anecdotally, I think that's great.
Yeah. You can't just go there and wing it.
You're just going to look an idiot, aren't you? It's going to damage your brand. It's going to damage the technology if you just decide to rock up there and haven't got proper data, because it will fall through and it will be game over. But I think people can take a lot of reassurance from that.
Cool. Any other stocks you've been looking at? Anything
no, else? No. How's
Where
your
are you
portfolio?
At cash-wise? Where are you at cash-wise now?
Yeah, I'm about the same as you. I've just, as I mentioned, I had the big dump of cash from Crestchick in February. Yeah. But then last week, I got a big dump of US dollars from Amrit Pharma, which got paid out. So okay. I've now got about 40% cash I'm looking to deploy. And it's the same sort of, I'm not going to go, immediately just buying. I'm just going to sort of slowly sort of drip feed stuff into the market over 3 to 9 months, and really the investment strategy is staying the same. I'm looking ideally for technology or healthcare, good pricing power, lots of IP, strong, ideally a strong balance sheet. Well, will be a strong balance sheet, and just take my time on it. I mean, yeah. I think there's lots. I mean, my stock watch list is enormous. I mean, it really is. I could buy lots and lots of stocks, but I just want to sort of like, take my time. And ideally, if I can go into the areas that I want to, and let's be clear about it, my risk tolerance is different to a lot of people's. I mean, I have a lot of volatility, so my risk tolerance is very high. Mm-hmm. And my, investment time horizons is longer than most people, i.e. it's sort of like, 3, 5, 7 years. I mean, that's what I sort of hold on. People can't, they don't have the same sort of like, objectives as I do, to as much as anything. I mean, I've done very well over 23 years in my returns. I'm delighted, but let's be clear about it. I've had lots of sleepless nights and lots of volatility, and I wouldn't always wish that on other people, because it can be painful.
Yeah, I know. It's almost like when I've had that with stocks where I felt such a big position in it, looking to every angle, every bit of news coming out, you're thinking, I don't want to be like that, So
you get battered worrying. Down, you get worn down by it.
Yeah, exactly. Any tick down in the stock, but, beyond like 2, 3, 4, 5%, you think, oh, no. And you think, oh, selling, it's going to go down further. Yeah, so you want to be at the level where it doesn't matter if a stock drops off like 10% or something, because it doesn't affect your portfolio that much. If it does, a 10% drop really knocks your portfolio, you're probably overexposed,
Hey, well, I mean, one where I am overexposed, I mean, I would say is, it's equals, and I can't remember exactly how much it is, but, it's a good 22% of my portfolio, I think. I'd have to have a look at it exactly, but I know it's in the 20s. It's a big position because it's done well, but I still believe in the guys. And yeah, if that goes down, then it's going to knock my portfolio to, you know, a big hole. But I've been through those before, and you know, it's just that most investors probably don't want to have that position size as big as I've got it, you know. And I wouldn't wish it on people, but you've got to, as I say, I think I've mentioned it before, you only know your risk tolerance when you blow through it. That's when you know. Yeah, it, because then it's caused you so much pain.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, exactly.
And it gets bigger as you get older.
I know. You know what, at the moment, I've got nothing over like 8% total.
Oh, okay. Well, you kept yourself pretty on the firm leash there, haven't you?
Well, that's it. I think at the moment, my initial investment, I just go quite small on, and I think, okay, let's see, you know, if I'm right or wrong. If I'm wrong, at least, or temporarily wrong, you know, then at least it's not going to knock my portfolio value too much. And if it starts to go right, maybe, you know, I'll average up a bit and put a bit more in. But just sick of the last 18 months of just sitting on in a big paper loss or losses and just thinking, I've had enough of that. You know, and I don't know how long it's going to go for. You know, I don't think it's going to, the market's not going to change like it did in the great financial crash. It was 2 years, of course. But I mean, we're now over 560 days since the high on AIM. That's a long time. 560 days. I think we're coming to even longer than the average, you know, bear market here. So, but I don't know if it's going to be, I think it's going to be one of those rangy things. You see certain stocks like rallying, the microcaps at the moment, going nuts, and then they'll come back down. And
I would go back to the very first thing we talked about, the VIX at 17. That smacks to me is that we're going to have a sell-off in the next few weeks. It's just too damn low. I mean, I just don't feel safe with that. It's basically saying everybody's on the same boat, on the same side of the boat, that the market is essentially, you've got your professionals who have all universally said, actually, the fundamentals don't stack up as we look at it on a probability basis to where the prices are. So they've exited the market, but you've had basically investors or passives or whatever it is coming into, you know, coming up, taking up that slack and creating effectively a fake level of, you know, sort of like calmness on the market. It's 17 times VIX is if you chart it, you know, alongside the S&P 500, it is by far and away the best, you know, best indicator of countercyclical, you know, sort of movements, i.e. 17 says, traditionally says sell, 30 says buy. And 17 is just too low to me.
Do you know what? I'm looking at it now, and oddly, we are at the lowest we've been since going back in January, and it went a bit lower in October, and of course, October's were the lows. So,
yeah.
And it's looking like it's heading down towards that low, so there may be a bit of a sell-off happening. You're right there. So,
It just smells... It smells to complacency to me.
Sell everything.
No. I'm trading through it. I'm not selling.
Don't get complacent. Don't go crazy and think there's a new bull market starting.
I just think we just need to be prepared for the next three or four. Get us through this earnings season. But my instinct is saying earnings season, higher inflation, Fed tightening, Bank of England tightening. Until we get, I think the Bank of England's mid-March, I would say the next month, and given where the VIX is, we're going to get volatility. I just cannot see it, not perfectly honest, but I could be wrong. If we get a ceasefire in Ukraine, well, flipping hell, game's on again, you know.
Yeah, when is that going to happen? Right, marvellous stuff. Cheers.
Take care. Cheers and bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.